Director's report. Director Jim.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Looking at your book under section three of the written report, I'm not sure if I've had a chance to do that yet, but I'm not going to. Oh, excuse me. I'm not going to go through that in detail, but there are a couple items that I want to bring your attention to, and probably the first one is within the wildlife program section, and it's on grizzly bears. And I just wanted to make a couple of points there. Folks have probably already heard the National Park Service and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service are currently doing some scoping and having some public meetings to explore the idea of reintroduction of grizzly bears in the North Cascades National Park. The department has been there. We're a cooperating agent in that we are providing information and assisting with technical information to the process. If you look at the second page there, you'll see that we have an analysis or a copy of our statute that talks about reintroduction of grizzly bears and what role the department can take. One, I think, an important part of that statute is it says grizzly bears shall not be transplanted or introduced into the state. So that's an indication, the statute says, to me, bears can't be brought in from out of state. So there are some management tools we could do within the state, but at this point, I think the department is watching the process, and we're interested to see where the service will go on this and where what they're going to do with their environmental impact statement. So wanted to bring that to your attention. They've had several meetings around the state, and I would guess they will have more meetings. Some people haven't been too happy with the format of an open house meeting. They would like to have a format where they could have more public interchange. So the next item is also a wildlife item that I'd like to talk about a little bit, and that's the elk hoof disease issue. The department has started conducting a citizen science process there, where we've trained about almost 300 volunteers to identify and look for animals that have hoof disease. The idea behind that is to determine the overall prevalence of the disease. We're having them do several motor surveys and other things around the area in Southwest Washington. We're also looking or to get a handle on the overall distribution of the disease, and those folks are helping with that. And then we're having a more intensive look where we put out, I think, almost 90, the number's on there, 78 GPS radio collars. The purpose of those collars is to look at the impacts on survival and productivity of this disease on our elk herds. The next part of this is some of these animals are severely impacted, and from a humanitarian standpoint, they need to be dispatched when they're found, and we need to do that in an efficient way. And so we're looking at some procedures to use our master hunters and to get our conservation officers to efficiently take care of some of these animals that are severely impacted and not going to recover. So we need to be responsive to that. I was recently at a sportsman's meeting in the area, and people are very concerned, and on several levels. And one of them is the humanitarian level, if you will. That's just they care for these animals greatly, and to see an animal suffer like that is very difficult. And so we need to make sure we're very responsive and help people and learn as much about this disease as soon as we can. Let's see. I'm going to ask for some help on a couple of other items from some of the staff, but before I get to there, I wanted to talk about a couple of other items. One item is we've been working on my performance agreement. I think that Deputy Storer has passed that out. It's a draft at this point. Please take a look at that. We'd like to visit again. We can visit informally, I guess, in April, but I would like to get that finalized by the May Commission meeting. So I'd like to, if you have a chance to provide some feedback on that document, I'd appreciate it. It'll probably look similar to what we had with Commissioner or Director Anderson. It's because it's been updated. We didn't see a need to reinvent the wheel. But if there are emphasis areas and parts of that that you would like to for the department and for me to take a look at, please let me know. And we'll get that on the books. What's that? Yeah. The other item that we've passed out is the delegation of authority document. That provides a mechanism for you to delegate authority to the director's office and the department for things that are within your purview, but you don't have the day-to-day time to visit. And so that's also a document that you've all seen, I think, in the past, and it's been updated with new names and duties, and so I'd like to get your okay on that also, and would like to move forward at about the same timeline if we could. The other item I wanted to call your attention to is, I believe, has also been passed out. You have a copy of Francine Madden's report. Francine Madden was the lady that's been doing a stakeholder conflict assessment of the people and the wolf issues in Washington. Maybe some of the folks in this room were interviewed by Francine. Anyway, it's a document that she's put out, and it's a report back to the commission. It kind of talks about the social landscape of this issue, identifies some of the major groups that are impacted, and their feelings, I guess, if you will, about the department and each other, and a bit of there's some exploration about their own thoughts and feelings about wolves and how we will react with wolves now and into the future. And I think she has some interesting insights. I encourage everyone to read it, and we'll make this available to the public too, probably on our website soon, and so all of you can take a look. It's pretty insightful work, and I think she did a nice job. Those of us that had a chance to spend some time with Francine, at least I'll speak for myself, I found her to be very thoughtful she is an interesting person, and her approach to these kind of topics was very good. So anyway, please give some time to that document, and I think you'll find it insightful. A couple other items. I'm going to ask for some help with staff. Jim, could you please give us all a briefing on where we're at with the North of Falcon process?
Chair Smith, Director Ensworth, and members of the Commission, I'm Jim Scott. I'm head of the Fish Program, Department of Fish and Wildlife. And appreciate the opportunity to give you a quick briefing on North of Falcon. Some of you have had the opportunity to participate in it over the years. It includes over 20 tribes, federal government, 3 states, and I would safely say, I think, hundreds of stakeholders. And the objective is to shape our salmon fisheries consistent with our conservation objectives and to share the allowable harvest between the tribes, the state, and within the state, our various stakeholder groups. For this coming season, we have a really significant conservation challenge in Puget Sound in particular. We're projecting 25% fewer Chinook coming back than when they were listed as threatened in 1999. Just a couple numbers there for you. For example, the Sauk River projected return is 406 Chinook salmon. North Fork Stillaguamish, 372. So a difficult year, again, it seems like, in terms of trying to identify fisheries that provide opportunities for our stakeholders and meet our conservation objectives. We've been working very closely with recreational fishers during the last 8 months to identify some specific improvements, particularly in the Puget Sound area. Some of those ideas that we've developed include reducing the minimum size limit during the winter fisheries, putting in place a mark selective fishery during July in Area 7, north kind of the San Juans area, and trying to improve the likelihood of being able to take home a coho by putting a two-pole rule in place in southern Puget Sound during the month of October. And kind of more generally, to try and reestablish some of the recreational fisheries that have been lost during the years. So we're maybe a third of the way through the process, I'd say. We've got an initial analysis of both the Puget Sound sport option that we put out, as well as all of the other commercial fisheries, both on the tribal side and on the non-treaty side. And I suspect, not too surprisingly, we've got some real difficult challenges in front of us trying to shape those fisheries and get them consistent with our conservation objectives. So just a couple examples there. Again, most of these Puget Sound stocks, they're limited by ESA limits on the percentage of the stock that can be harvested. So, for example, the Nisqually River, the limit under the ESA permit is 52% of them could be harvested at a max. The current proposals on the table have about 60% of them being harvested. That's a pretty big gap there. Another example is Lake Washington, where the ESA permit level is a 20% maximum impact on Lake Washington fish, and the current proposal has an impact of about 29%. So, again, significant challenges from a number of perspectives. We will be working with the tribes, the states, the federal government, our stakeholders during the next 4 weeks to align all of the objectives to the best we can, and that will come to a conclusion at the PFMC meeting in California, April 11th to 16th. We do have a large number of public meetings during this process. In fact, I think we've got two next week in eastern Washington, in Clarkston, I believe, and Kennewick. So with that, I'll take any questions that you might have.
Okay, thanks for that update.
Commissioner Olsen.
Thank you, Chair. Right off the get-go, you were telling about a couple of rivers where you had 300 and 400 fish returning. Where are we at as far as spawners do you need on those rivers? I mean, just to put it in perspective, how dire a situation you're looking at.
That's a very good question. And the way we do our management, we have different thresholds of concern. And we have a threshold that's called a critical concern, where below that, you dial back fisheries as much as you can. And so for the Sauk River, I believe I said the projected return is 406. The critical level for that particular population is 400, so it's right at that critical level. The other example I had, North Fork Stillaguamish, projected 372. Its critical level is 500, so below that critical level.
Thanks, Jim. Nate, would you please come up and give us a real brief description of where we're at with our legislation that's in on wolves, the status of that?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the Commission, Director Unsworth. There are
12 bills that had dropped during this legislative session associated with wolves, 8 in the House and 4 in the Senate. Cutoff for bills coming out of Chamber of Origin was March 11th, and so there's currently 4 wolf bills that remain in play. 2 bills are companion bills. Senate Bill 5960 and House Bill 2107 are now in the opposite chambers. Both of those bills direct the department to amend the wolf plan. It doesn't outline specifics as far as what it should say, but it identifies areas that the department needs to explore in its revision. The Senate version of the bill it would exempt the department from taking this plan through SEPA. The House bill has that provision struck, as well as identifies that we would be taking this amended plan through our wolf advisory group and a scientific peer review process. So the department's been supportive of both bills. We think this is, given the variety of bills that were out there, this is seems like a good vehicle and for us to take a look at. We've been managing wolves. The plan was adopted in December of 2011, so we've had 3 field seasons under our belt, and there's some lessons learned as well as some updated science. Some of the population viability analysis that we did in our wolf plan is going through peer review. Right now, we're expecting it to be published this spring in the Journal of Wildlife Management, so that will be very useful for us to apply different management scenarios, different recovery objectives, different recovery zones, et cetera, in this update to the plan. There's also a bill that came out of the House Bill 1676, that asks, I believe it's University of Washington, to take a look at ungulate populations and potential impacts associated with wolf recovery. So we've been supportive of that process. It's been something that we're actually doing, as you're aware, in the updated game management plan, where we have an assessment of our ungulate populations associated with predator prey. So this will be a complementary process that UW would be conducting. Finally, a bill that came out of the Senate is 5583, and it calls for the ability for the commission to regionally delist terrestrial mammals. We've had some concerns about this bill. There's been some versions in the House that ended up not proceeding further. But generally, our concerns have been, the unintended impacts to other listed species. So there's 10 state listed terrestrial mammals, and so if it's about wolves, we've been providing testimony about this amending that bill to be focused on wolves, as well as there's been some other concerns about the regional delisting process. How do we achieve statewide recovery under that scenario, as well as the bill would have the plan incorporate a lot of county consultation and socioeconomic considerations. All very important values to absolutely include, but oftentimes when we're looking at the decision on based on the biology and science and the persistence and recovery of an animal, we try to just keep that focused on the biology. And then certainly when you're looking at different actions or in the services consideration, for instance, on critical habitat designation, that's where the socioeconomic factors come into play. So a little bit of procedural concerns there. But those are the 4 bills still in play.
Thank you, Chair Smith. Nate, just so I understand, if House Bill 2107 or a version of that or 5960 in the Senate comes through, and let's say it has the provision of the process of relooking at the wolf plan, is going through the Wolf Advisory Group. I think I'm correct in that would still come back to the Commission as a final decision if changes were to be made to the Wolf Plan, such as changing the number of regions or changing the metrics of successful recovery from breeding pairs to packs. Anything like that will be going through a process through the WAG, and then eventually end up, though, in a public process that would take some time. And I think there's not, assuming we'd have as much time into it as when the plan was originally drafted, but the commission would be much more involved in the suggestions or recommendations from the WAG to change the Wolf Plan. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Caney, yes, there would be extensive public process involved, and ultimately the decision would rest with this body. As we've been kind of penciling out what this process might look like in terms of the associated fiscal note for these bills, what we're probably envisioning is a process of the environmental impact statement, analyzing a suite of alternatives, and within each alternative for some of the different areas that the legislature's asking us to explore. So you mentioned recovery zones or recovery objectives, or what's the minimum number of depredations. We might have several alternatives with each one of those bins. As we go through the EIS process and come up with the range of alternatives, ultimately that would go in front of the commission, and the commission might say, well, we're looking at this for recovery objectives, we're looking at this for recovery zones, this is the minimum number of depredations before the department would do in lethal removal, out of a range of options. Then that would then, that direction essentially would be passed on to department staff, and we would write the plan according to your prescription.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And now I guess I'd like Joe Storer to give us just a brief update on a couple of items, Tianaway, and where we're at with our budget legislation.
Thank you, Director. Good morning, Commissioners. Tianaway, let me start with that. You probably remember that about a year ago, the legislature approved nearly $100 million to purchase about 50,000 acres in the Tianaway Basin. Tianaway is located sort of northeast of Cle Elum. And this purchase was supported by a very broad set of constituents. It had support of both the Republicans and Democrats in the legislature. And in large part, that support came because of its relationship to the Yakima Basin integrated planning process, where irrigators, local governments, conservation groups got together and are looking for ways to make themselves drought-proof. That basin has experienced significant droughts, two major droughts in the last 15 years. And so with that political push behind it, the funding was made available, the land was purchased, and it's co-managed between the Department of Fish and Wildlife and the Department of Natural Resources. DNR holds the fee title, and we are co-managers via an easement agreement that takes place between the two agencies. It's managed as a community forest trust. That was a statute that was put in place for DNR several years ago, and it calls for the continuation of a working lands kind of approach, as well as some conservation that's heavily advised and guided by the local community. So we have a 20-member advisory community committee, and they've been working really hard on the first deliverable of that statute, which is a management plan. And we should have a management plan out in the next month, in April. And if you're interested in seeing that, please let me know. I can make that available to the commission. We have a deadline in statute of June 30th for completion of the management plan, and it deals with all kinds of things from habitat conservation, species preservation, road use, grazing, forestry, etc. And we have a very strong, diverse group, and it's encouraging to see the consensus behind this plan so far. We've had a pretty good process. So if you want to know more about that, please let me know. Let me switch to budget, and then I'll cover our fee bill, status of our fee bill, too. So as you know, this is the long legislative session scheduled to go till about April 27th, unless they have special sessions, which is very possible. It's a very tough budget discussion that's going on now. And as we've talked in the past, the McCleary decision that puts a lot of focus on funding through K through 12 education, is a huge pressure on the general fund, as well as the transportation budget and a number of other issues. So a great, huge challenge for the legislature. We will see, I think, today the latest revenue forecast. And typically in a legislative session, we have a revenue forecast in December and another in March. The legislature uses those projections on future revenue for the next biennium, about 2.5 years out, to set their budget, to try to balance their budget. We're expecting this revenue forecast to really not show any significant change from what we saw in December. So it's not going to be a big help to the problem statement. And that means a lot of pressure on our general fund. We have about $61, $62 million of general fund remaining from the $110 million we had 5 years ago. And we're watching very carefully to see what sorts of discussions occur around general fund and reductions there. I think it's safe to say that that general fund amount is at risk. Now, whether it goes away or, as in the past has often happened, it's substituted with other fund sources, we'll wait and see. So what's that mean to our fee bill? Right now, Senate Bill 5632 is the commercial and rec fishing license fee bill. It's, I'll say, barely alive. It's necessary to implement the budget, so that means the cutoff dates for that you might hear about for policy bills don't apply. It's in the Senate Natural Resources Committee. Senator Pearson is the chair of that committee, and we're in pretty frequent conversations with the senator. That bill was developed last summer to deal with three things: to deal with some federal funding cuts, to deal with some cost increases, and to bring about some improvements in our shellfish enforcement and in fish production. We were targeting about $6.4 million in new revenue that would have been generated by an addition of a dollar to our combination fishing license, about $2 to our other fishing and shellfishing licenses, and about $5 increase to our out-of-state fishing licenses. So those fairly minimal increases would have generated about $6.4 million, and in addition, the commercial fees would basically double. We were talking about just a 100% increase in commercial fees at the time. Spent a lot of time with stakeholders working that. The recreational fishing stakeholders had a number of things they wanted to see accomplished before they would express support on the commercial side. A lot of discussions, and I think generally we have the commercial sector's support for that portion of the fee bill at this point in time. Since then, or after the summer got over and we went through the fall, the governor's budget came out in December, and that presented some additional problems. We saw about a $7.4 million impact in the governor's budget on top of what we were dealing with during the summer in our fee bill. That $7.4 million was related to some of the 15% reduction exercise that we put forward. It was related to additional cost increases, especially in salaries and benefits for our employees. If you take the employees that are tied to our wildlife fund, unrestricted wildlife fund, those increases had to do with what's called a class study, a survey study, where they go in and look at various classes of individuals, of employees, and compare them to the private sector and either adjust or not the salary ranges they operate within. We had a number of adjustments to our biologists, to our sergeants in law enforcement, to some of our administrative staff that resulted in a million or two in terms of cost increases there. There was the collective bargaining agreements that the governor negotiates with the various unions. We have four unions in our organization, and so there's a proposal in the governor's budget for a 3% salary increase in year one of next biennium and a 1.5% increase in year two. So there are additional costs there. There are costs associated with health care, with pensions, et cetera. So our original problem statement in the fee bill of about $6.4 million had about another $7 million plus added to it. So we're looking at a revenue shortage, of around $13 to $14 million. We're talking to the legislature about that. We expect, the forecast coming out today will result in a House budget proposal around the 30th of March, and maybe on the 30th or shortly thereafter a Senate budget proposal. And we'll look to see whether the fee bill is included in the Senate, because that's the only part of the legislature we have a bill alive in, and what the House does with that $13, $14 million problem. If we were to have to deal with $13, $14 million deficit, and looking at, and I've shown you this before, our general fund and our wildlife fund are in fairly specific and limited categories, we would see that there's no way to avoid impacts to our hatchery production, probably hatchery closures, a number of them, enforcement capacity, our hydraulic project approval permit system, our administrative functions, of course, management, all of those areas would see some significant impacts. And so as we're putting together the specifics around those reductions, I'm going to be sharing that with all of you so you have a sense. We're going to use that to talk to stakeholders real soon, talk to legislators about what that scenario might look like, and try to generate some energy and support for not having those bad things happen. So with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Shoe to drop.
Perhaps we could discuss I will have those specifics in our early April conference call. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair. And finally, I'll finish up my report. I'll have to apologize for bad manners, but here we are in Region 2. And Jim, will you please stand up? And this is Jim Brown, our regional director. Is there anything that you'd like to say? And I would like to say thanks to the folks that live here, and we appreciate the use of this nice facility and being able to have this meeting. But, Jim, any quick points you'd like to add? And I think our time's just about up for my report. So,
thank you, Mr. Director, Commissioners, Mr. Chairman. A year ago, you may recall, I was here. I met you for the first time. I was here to report that we had a fracture in Wanapum Dam. And a lot more unknowns, a lot of questions, probably a lot of questions as to whether we were going to be able to deal with the problems that we didn't even fully have scoped out at the time. And I'm pleased to report that the grant PUD starting this week has initiated the final pool raise to get the pool back up. In the year's time since that occurred, we responded to a lot of problems. One of the key issues that we dealt with right away was the impact to irrigators. Many of the irrigators that operate at the upper end of the pool just downstream from Wenatchee, their irrigation connections were left high and dry. And there's a fairly significant permitting process both for HPA and for Department of Ecology regulations in order to get those irrigation systems back up and running. We were able to expedite the permitting process through various staff, both at the regional and at the headquarters level, and in working in concert with Department of Ecology. And I'm happy to say that all of those irrigators got their water within the time that they needed it. Even though the incident occurred in March, and you don't normally think about that being a time in which you do irrigation, they use irrigation water, for those of you who are unfamiliar with it, they use it for frost protection. They actually put water in low-temperature nighttime regimes on those trees when they're getting close to budding out so that it keeps those buds from getting damaged. Actually, the ice prevents them from being harmed worse. So they were able to get that water and get that job going. And at the same time, the PUD, which was obviously the lead, they have the engineers and the infrastructure, was working on the problem that I reported to you about fish passage. Because the water was drawn down approximately 20 feet, the entrances to the fish ladders were high and dry. And those fish ladders are gravity-fed. So if the water's not spilling into the top of the fish ladder, you don't have fish passage. And as we all know now, especially in hindsight, we had the largest fish runs to the Upper Columbia since 1938. And we knew those fish were coming. So we were very fortunate in the timing of those runs that it provided enough time for the PUD to come up with an engineering fix whereby they pumped water with diesel pumps and modified the outfall of the fish ladder so that those fish could essentially ride a water slide down to the water with little to no impact. And again, I'm happy to report, we know now that we had great fish returns, and we have no notable impacts because of the drawdown to fish passage or injuries to those fish. So I think it was a great example of problem solving, not just by DFW, but by Grant PUD and them stepping up to the problem that they had and working in close concert with all the other agencies and partners and solving those problems. So I just felt it was noteworthy to bring it up because it was 1 year ago that I spoke to you, and it happens to be the time now that the pool's coming back up. So by the end of the week, by the end of next week, we hope to be back up at full pool and normal operations. So, any questions?
Thank you. Yep.
Thanks.
I remember last year the news was a lot bleaker.
Well, yeah, it was a big unknown.
Right,
I mean, we were hopefully optimistic, and it turned out that it worked out. So, thank you.
With that, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, that concludes the Director's Report.